Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Janet Jaleel, and at 14 hours GMT on Friday the 29th of March, these are our main stories. The authorities in South Africa say rescue workers have so far retrieved 20 bodies from the site of a bus crash in which 45 people died. Syria has blamed Israel for airstrikes near the city of Aleppo, which are reported to have killed dozens of people. The Chinese technology firm Huawei says its profits more than doubled last year, despite US sanctions. Also in this podcast...
And this has been one of the most exciting developments in cancer treatment in the last few years, that our ability to kind of retrain our immune system to remove damaged cells. We'll be giving the drugs before any tumours arise.
How immunotherapy drugs could be an alternative to surgery for those with the breast cancer gene. Police in South Africa are investigating why a bus plunged off an elevated section of road into a ravine, bursting into flames and killing 45 people. An 8-year-old girl is thought to be the sole survivor. She's in hospital with serious injuries. The passengers who'd set off from Botswana were travelling to an Easter church service. I got more details from our correspondent, Shingai Inyoka.
What the transport minister said is that this accident happened at 11 a.m. on Thursday. So it was in broad daylight. There was no oncoming traffic. This bus crashed into a ravine about 50 metres below the bridge. And so it's really been difficult to access the scene of the accident, the crash site, to retrieve some of those bodies. It's a relatively large operation with sniffer dogs. And we understand that a crane might be brought in to try to lift this bus up to try to recover some more of those victims.
Yes, and it seems that nearly everyone on board died apart from this one little girl.
Yes, and it's quite an amazing story. The reason why she survived, they say, is because she was flung out of the vehicle. There was another woman that was flung out of the vehicle, but she also died on her way to hospital. They didn't really stand a chance. If you look at those pictures, where the ravine was just such a, it was just such a long drop. And even if you look at some of those pictures from the crash site, there's debris strewn everywhere, and there were also gas canisters because they were attending a church service, and so would have been outdoors and would have to cook for themselves, and so that also likely contributed to the inferno in which so many people died.
Shingai Inyoka, well, the road was one not recommended for use by large vehicles because it has so many hairpin bends. Colin Mcibi is a national spokesperson for South Africa's Department of Transport, and James Copnell asked him if there are questions to be answered about the condition of this particular road.
I honestly think the road isn't bad, even though, of course, the biggest issue we have in the country is the road user behavior. So far, we cannot speculate in terms of what caused the accident. What we do know is that he lost control of the bus. But what the problems we have here is about the driver behavior, which we continue to emphasize that no matter what we do, we've got about 23,000 traffic officers in the country. The vehicle population, we're talking about 16 million vehicles. So you can imagine, we can't police each and every vehicle that is on the road. So it comes down to the road user behavior in terms of how do they take care of themselves when they are on the road. So we do not want to say it is the condition of the road that may have led to what has happened, in fact. But I think it may be the issue of the road user behavior or the driver behavior in this case.
I mean, I understand the point about the responsibility of the driver, but perhaps had there been a stronger barrier, given that this was on the edge of a ravine, it's possible that it simply wouldn't have gone off the edge, no?
Especially our national roads are in very much good condition. Provincial roads, somehow you could start questioning some of these barriers. And I can't speculate in terms of the condition of this barrier. But such things have also happened on good roads. So honestly, as I say, we can not always blame it on the barrier as such. So when we say we lost control of the bus, what does it really mean?
Colin Imsibi, national spokesperson for South Africa's Department of Transport. Reports from Syria say more than 40 people have been killed in Israeli airstrikes. Syria's defense ministry says Israeli planes targeted several sites near the northwestern city of Aleppo. Most of the dead are believed to be Syrian troops, and a number are fighters from the Lebanese armed group Hezbollah. Our Middle East correspondent, Yolande Nell, is following developments from Jerusalem. She told us what was known about the attack near Aleppo.
The Syrian authorities are very clear blaming Israel for this attack, but I did ask the Israeli military this morning and they were very clear that they don't comment on reports in foreign media. This is kind of a stock response we get from them, particularly when it comes to cases in Syria. So it kind of limits what you can say from here. But, I mean, now looking around all the reports emerging, these are areas in the countryside around Aleppo that were hit. The UK-based Observatory for Human Rights, which has very strong sources on the ground, says that these were close to rocket depots, the areas hit belonging to the Lebanese group Hezbollah. Most of those killed Syrian soldiers, according to the Syrian Observatory for Human Rights, but also several people from Hezbollah. And we've also got Reuters quoting security sources saying something along similar lines. The Syrian state news agency had come out saying it was civilians and military personnel who were killed.
What does this tell us about the situation for the wider region? Because we're also seeing an increase of attacks in the cross-border region between Israel and Lebanon.
That's right. And these two things look likely to be related. You know, we already know that when it comes to attacks that Israel has carried out inside Syria, and it has previously talked about having carried out hundreds of strikes inside Syria since the 2011 civil war started, it's very often been trying to prevent weapons being transferred to Hezbollah, this powerful Lebanese armed group which is backed by Iran. And we know it's also targeted the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps in Syria as part of this kind of proxy war that often goes on between Israel, this sort of shadow war we often hear about between Israel and Iran, which involve its proxies around the region.
Yolande Nell. And since we spoke to Yolande, the Israeli military has said it has killed the deputy commander of Hezbollah's rocket and missile section in an airstrike in southern Lebanon. It said Ali Abed Aksan Naim had been responsible for conducting and planning attacks against Israeli civilians. Video released online by Israel showed a moving vehicle exploding after being struck by a missile. If you discover that you're carrying the gene mutation which causes breast cancer, then you're faced with a difficult choice. You can decide to have a mastectomy, as Angelina Jolie did, or run the risk of developing the disease. Now, a new study by the University of Cambridge here in the UK has found that immunotherapy cancer drugs could provide an alternative to surgery. Professor Walid Khalid, a senior author of the study, has been explaining the findings to Martha Carney.
We all know that prevention is better than cure, and risk of developing breast cancer is affected by things such as age, breastfeeding, and germline mutations such as the BRCA1, BRCA2 carriers that you highlighted. But up to this moment, really, we haven't had a detailed map of how these factors change the normal healthy breast. So we fixed this problem, and over the last 5 years, we built this detailed map of how these factors change the cellular ecosystem within the breast. And one of the big surprises from our study, which is, I should say, this is the world's largest map of this cellular changes, in the BRCA1, BRCA2 healthy tissue, we find exhausted immune cells. And this is surprising because normally these cells are found at late stage tumors. So what are exhausted immune cells? They are basically, our immune system is there to protect us against infection and disease, so to remove damaged cells. What tends to happen is, effectively, the cells can become dysfunctional and they can't remove these cells, so they kind of got termed exhausted.
And that's where immunotherapy comes in, doesn't it? Because it sort of stimulates these exhausted cells in order to kill and destroy the cancerous ones.
Exactly, and this has been one of the most exciting developments in cancer treatment in the last few years, is our ability to kind of reactivate or retrain our immune system to remove damaged cells. So actually what's happening now is, with this detailed understanding of the biology of how tumors develop and initiate, We've now initiated a new study with support from CRUK, Cancer Research UK, to be testing multiple compounds actually in a preclinical model, including immunotherapy, to see if we could prevent tumour onset. So basically we'd be giving the drugs before any tumours arise.
Professor Valid Khalid. 1 year ago today, Evan Gershkovich of the Wall Street Journal was arrested in Russia and accused of being a spy. His detention sent shockwaves through the foreign correspondent community. Nothing, of course, compared to the shock felt by Mr. Gershkovich's family back home in America. Our Russia editor, Steve Rosenberg, reports from Moscow on an American journalist in a Russian jail.
I'm standing opposite a large four-storey building with pale yellow walls and barbed wire. This is Lefortovo Jail. It was built in Tsarist Russia, and some of Russia's most high-profile prisoners have been incarcerated here, including political prisoners and dissidents. Former inmates say that the most unnerving thing about this place is the sense of total isolation. Locked up here is an American journalist, Evan Gershkovich. 1 year ago, we caught a fleeting glimpse of the Wall Street Journal reporter as he was driven away to Lefortovo. Evan Gershkovich had been arrested and accused of spying, the first US journalist in Russia since the Cold War to be charged with espionage.
The insinuations that he was somehow engaging in some kind of criminal activity is just flat out false.
Lynn Tracy is the US ambassador to Russia and one of the few people who've been allowed inside Lefortovo Jail to see Evan.
He is managing, he's in good health, he's dealing extremely well with the day-to-day circumstances. It's not easy when there are so many uncertainties. He was and is a journalist who was doing his job. The message is release him now.
It's been a really difficult year, and the uncertainty is very hard to deal with. But
Danielle Gershkovich is Evan's older sister. Speaking from Washington, she tells me about the letters Evan's been writing from prison and the ones she writes back.
We have a lot of sibling banter back and forth, a lot of teasing with love. I recently was asking him if it's okay for me to see the Dune movie, the sequel, in theaters. Felt guilty about seeing it since he can't. And he tells me about books he reads.
Is it true that he sent some flowers from prison?
Yes. We want him to focus on himself, and here he is taking care of us. But it was so nice for International Women's Day. He arranged for the women in his life to receive some bouquets. He supports the people in his life. We desperately miss him.
Last month, Vladimir Putin claimed he'd love to see Evan Gershkovich go home. But the Kremlin wants something, or rather someone, in return. That someone is thought to be an FSB officer, Vadim Krasikov, who's serving a life sentence for murder in Germany. The Wall Street Journal's editor-in-chief, Emma Tucker, believes that as far as Evan is concerned, the Russians took him to trade him.
Russia has latched onto the fact that there's a currency it can use. And it's, to be frank, stockpiling Americans in its jails in order to be able to trade them at a later date. Evan is a hostage. He is a bargaining chip. Putin is holding him as currency. And that is just the brutal reality of it. And it makes it very, very difficult for governments to know exactly how to approach this, because there's a lot at stake here, including what might happen in the future.
Wall Street Journal editor-in-chief Emma Tucker ending that report by Steve Rosenberg. Still to come in this podcast, Oppenheimer finally premieres in Japan, the only nation to have suffered nuclear bombing, to mixed reactions.
When they were testing the bombs, and then the people there was like cheering for joy that, you know, it succeeded it, and that disgusted me.
The Global Story helps make sense of the headlines with expert analysis from BBC journalists around the world.
Social media has essentially siloed a lot of young men and women into different algorithmic bubbles.
Men and women inhabiting the same environment in the real world, but very different ones online.
One global story at a time, in detail, every Monday to Friday from the BBC World Service.
For those Russians who sympathise with Alexei Navalny, it will cast a very dark shadow.
This looks like a message.
Search for The Global Story wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Welcome back to the Global News Podcast. More than 100 villages in Western Sudan have been set on fire since the civil war there began last year, according to analysis of satellite and social media. Researchers at the Center for Information Resilience said fire was being used as a weapon of war. Thousands of people have died across Sudan and around 10 million have been displaced in the power struggle between the army and a rival paramilitary force, the Rapid Support Forces. Our diplomatic correspondent, James Landell, told Michelle Hussein how images were used to piece together what was happening on the ground.
What they do at the Centre for Information Resilience is they use NASA technology to detect heat sources, fire. They then match that with satellite technology that images that can show, you know, areas that have been burnt. And then they match that with social media. Basically, a lot of the armed groups that are taking part in this violence share images with themselves, and then that breaks out onto social media, and you can use the data within that to work out where that image was taken and when. And if you match all that together, you can build up a picture of what's happening. And the reason you have to do this is because, you know, it's very, very difficult to get access to this part of Sudan. And essentially what they found that is over the last year, very conservatively, they've managed to establish that 108 villages and settlements have been burned and either fully or partially destroyed as a result of fire during this conflict.
Do we know who's...
It's a pretty stark fact, yeah, because it's displaced thousands of people.
Absolutely. And do we know who's responsible? Because broadly in this civil war, it's the Sudanese armed forces on one side and paramilitaries on the other.
This group does not specifically attribute responsibility because in each case, the data around who is responsible for each individual case is incredibly hard to establish. What they say, though, is that in a lot of these fires, there are images of fighters from one side in the conflict, the Rapid Support Forces, are seen very close to these fires. You also see other allied Arab militia who are also involved or close to it, it's seen in these images. So clearly they are responsible for, a part of it. There's also some evidence that some of the fires were caused as a result of airstrikes by the Sudanese armed forces, the other side of the conflict. And then there's also some evidence that some of the fires are caused by intercommunal fighting that is very, very localised. Groups that are using the conflict as cover to settle long-standing scores. But I think it would be fair to say that the bulk of responsibility is almost always pointed at the Rapid Support Forces. Whenever this is put to them, it's very hard to get communications with, but when it is put to them, they tend to, you know, deny that their responsibility.
James Landell. The Chinese tech giant Huawei has been at the centre of an intense standoff between the United States and China. When the US and other countries placed restrictions on the firm over fears that its links to the Chinese government posed a security risk, Huawei's revenues plummeted. But the company has turned its fortunes around. Shortly before we recorded this podcast, it announced $12 billion of profits, double that of last year. Mickey Bristow is our Asia Pacific editor.
It's an amazing turnaround, really. Just to remind listeners, before 2019, before the US sanctions, Huawei was a massive company producing consumer electronic devices like laptops, but also importantly, network equipment, infrastructure equipment to make all those mobile phones work. It was involved in dozens of countries across the world, including in the West. Now, what happened around 2019 was that a lot of Western nations decided to strip out this Huawei infrastructure from their networks, fearing that perhaps because the company's links to the Chinese government, there could be some kind of security risk. Also, the United States has banned Huawei from buying any or using any US technology, including microchips. And it was thought that that would really cripple the company. In fact, many commentators suggested that would be the end of Huawei. It hasn't been. It's come back amazingly well. And as you've given the figure there, $12 billion profit, $100 billion worth of turnover. So really has bounced back, rebounded after those sanctions were imposed.
Because other Chinese companies have gone bust, how was Huawei able to avoid the same fate?
A couple of things, really. One, it's diversified into cloud computing. It's moved into the electric vehicle market using its software know-how to combine with car manufacturers. So that's a couple of things it's done. It's also last year launched a smartphone, which has really taken off in China, and that's boosted its finances as well. It's also received a lot of subsidies from the Chinese government, which wants to develop its own microchip industry inside of China, so it's got those subsidies. There's also a suggestion and allegations from American organizations that perhaps as well Huawei is trying to circumvent some of these US restrictions by buying up smaller companies and getting those to buy chip technology and equipment from the United States in order to benefit Huawei. So the US might be coming up with new sanctions against Huawei in the future. So a combination of measures, really, which has seen it turn its fortunes around.
Mickey Bristow. Oppenheimer, the film about the creator of the nuclear bomb, has been showered with awards, including 7 Oscars. But it was always going to be a difficult watch in Japan, the only nation to have suffered nuclear bombings in Hiroshima and Nagasaki during the Second World War. During the film's simultaneous release with another hit, Barbie, many in Japan were offended by the Barbenheimer meme, which went viral. They saw it as trivializing the horrors of the US military's nuclear attacks, which killed hundreds of thousands of people, most of them civilians. Our Japan correspondent, Shaima Khalil, spoke to people in Hiroshima, including some survivors of the bombing.
Primary target, as is received, understood, over and out. It's Hiroshima.
The first atomic bomb exploded almost directly above the building in front of me. The Hiroshima Peace Memorial, also known as the A-bomb Dome, was the only structure left standing here.
The explosion of the bomb became a ball of fire, 1,800 feet across.
It's been preserved in the same state as immediately after the bombing on the 6th of August 1945. A carcass of a building, laid bare, with its walls charred, and a skeletal dome overlooking the Motoyasu River, where thousands of people whose skin was burning at the time jumped in. This was once a site of carnage. Now, I see visitors walking across the memorial park, some reading plaques, taking pictures, others listening to tour guides, with the famous Hiroshima tram in the background. Nearly 80 years on, the legacy of J. Robert Oppenheimer, the father of the atomic bomb, is ever present here in Hiroshima.
All America's industrial might and scientific innovation connected here. A secret laboratory.
Now, a film based on the life, work, and moral dilemma of the enigmatic scientist is finally being shown in Japan, nearly a year after its initial release.
Why? How about because this is the most important thing to ever happen in the history of the world?
Oppenheimer may be the year's most celebrated film, but for the people here in Hiroshima, the story cuts much deeper. Tomoyaki Mimaki was 3 years old when Hiroshima was hit. He was playing outside his house on the outskirts of the city and remembers seeing a bright light, then ash falling from the sky. He tells me about the burnt bodies in the city center where his mother rushed with him and his brother to search for his father. But none of these horrors were portrayed in the film, he told me after watching Oppenheimer.
I thought that the devastation of Hiroshima would appear somewhere in the storyline of the film, but it didn't. There were only scenes in the United States. I wanted them to show and tell what happened in Hiroshima. I wish they had shown the burnt ruins of Hiroshima. The museum here has displays of how the children's heads were burnt, how their clothes were burnt. I wanted people in the US in particular to be able to see this.
We're in the theater and the film just finished. Let's see what people make of it.
I was, let's say, shocked. And when I watch it, just in front of me, there is one survivor of atomic bomb. I was almost, like, offended in some scenes. Like, they are talking about Hiroshima again and again, but in a meeting room, not thinking about people. And at the same time, I felt how it's difficult to imagine what really happens on the ground when they plan it.
The scene that like made a big impression on me was when they were testing the bombs, and then the people there was like cheering for joy that you know it succeeded it, and that disgusted me. I felt really sick in my guts, but then like it made me really think about you know the reality of that time and that past of how how those people there could not have the imagination of the impact or how the people that would affect when they dropped that bomb.
In Japan, we've been taught that we're the victims of the bomb. But there's a part in the film that said, this bomb is going to save people's lives. This was very new to me, and it was an opportunity for me to learn a different point of view of the US and the world.
Mr. Mimaki and others who've lived through the aftermath of the bombing continue to speak out against nuclear weapons and want others to do the same.
I hope that the people of Japan, including other survivors of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, will see this film and have a conversation about it. The 100th anniversary of the atomic bombing will soon come. And when it does, there will not be a single survivor left to tell the story.
In the middle of the Hiroshima Memorial Park, visitors line up to ring the peace bell. On its surface, a world map without boundaries. The atomic energy symbol is placed where a log hits the bell. A message of caution and hope from a city that knows firsthand the terrors of nuclear warfare.
That report by Shaima Khalil. Mammals have long had to adapt to rapidly changing environments in order to survive. But now, for the first time, footage has captured how some animals are dramatically changing their behaviour because of climate change. Naturalists spent 5 years observing mammals for a new BBC television series presented by David Attenborough.
There are more than 6,000 species of mammals on Earth. And as our world changes, so must they.
Our climate and science reporter Esme Stallard told us what the production team uncovered.
They've captured for the first time on camera some of the adaptations that these mammals are showing to not only a warmer world, but also a world rapidly being changed by humans. So, for example, forests that have now been replaced by palm oil plantations, and how macaques that live there are having to deal with this new habitat and maybe different food sources.
And give us some examples. For instance, it's been quite devastating for Arctic foxes who are now turning to cannibalism.
Yeah, that was probably one of the most shocking parts of the series, and that was the one that really stuck with me. So effectively, Arctic foxes rely on the sea ice to get their food. So in this instance, what had happened is the sea ice hadn't formed, it was too warm. And what typically happens is polar bears will go out on the sea ice, they'll catch their prey, and the leftovers the Arctic foxes feed on. But without that sea ice, the polar bears can't do that. And that means there's no food for the Arctic foxes. So in one scene, we see an Arctic fox die, and sadly, because there's no other food around, other Arctic foxes end up feeding on it. And that's the first time we think that behavior is being captured on camera, and potentially speaks to the kind of difficulties that these species are facing as temperatures begin to rise.
And we also see otters and lemurs also having to adapt their behaviour.
Yeah, so there's not just, you know, the sort of sad scenes and I guess the losers of the situation, but what the series also shows is the amazing ability of mammals to adapt very quickly to changing circumstances. So those otters you mentioned have managed to return to the streets of Singapore, which is really brilliant. And also we have white sifaka lemurs. Now, what they've done is they're living in warming environment like many mammals, but what they've learned to do is they've learned to hug these trees called Salvadora trees, also called toothbrush trees, which I love. And what happens there is that those trees suck up cool water from the ground, so their trunks are very cool, so we see all the lemurs hugging the tree to stay cool. So it shows they are very adaptable, and it's a real celebration of these mammals.
Esme Stallard. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. And on Saturday, you can hear our weekly Happy Pod with Harry Bly.
Thanks, Jeanette. This week, we heard from one of our younger listeners in Doha. He wants our help tracking someone down to thank them for a gesture of kindness at the 2022 World Cup. Meet the scientists employing elephant seals to aid their ocean research. And the critically endangered mountain chicken frog. 6 froglets have just been born at London Zoo. We're also continuing our theme, learning about rare and endangered languages. This week, a man who's helping keep them alive. All that to come on the Happy Pod, in this podcast feed on Saturday.
And if you want to comment on the Happy Pod or this podcast, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Nora Hull. The producer was Carl Josephs. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Jeanette Jalil. Until next time, goodbye.